The agency was a backwater. Allergic and autoimmune disorders were hardly a factor in American life. Peanut allergies, asthma, and autoimmune diseases, e.g. diabetes and rheumatoid arthritis, were still so rare that their occasional occurrences in schoolchildren were novelties. Most Americans had never seen a child with autism. Only a tiny handful would recognize the term until the 1988 film Rain Man introduced it into the vernacular. Cancer was the disease Americans increasingly feared. With nearly all the attention of NIH and the bulk of federal health funding going to the National Cancer Institute, NCI. Worst of all, by the era of Dr. Fauci's ascendance as an ambitious bureaucrat at NIAID, infectious diseases were no longer a significant cause of death in America. Dramatic improvements in nutrition, sanitation, and hygiene had largely abolished the frightening mortalities from mumps, diphtheria, smallpox, cholera, rubella, measles, pertussis, puerperal fever, influenza, tuberculosis, and scarlet fever. The devastating lethality from these former scourges that decimated earlier generations of Americans had dwindled. From 1900, when one-third of all deaths were linked to infectious diseases, e.g. pneumonia, tuberculosis, and diarrhea and enteritis, through 1950, infectious disease mortality decreased dramatically, except for the 1918 Spanish flu, leveling off in the 1950s to what we see today, about 5% of all U.S. deaths. Annual deaths from communicable disease dropped in the 1980s to around 50 per 100,000 population, from 800 per 100,000 in 1900. By the 20th century, more people were dying of old age and heart attacks than from contagious illnesses. At NIAID and at its sister agency, CDC, the bug hunters were sliding into irrelevance. NIAID's heyday was a distant memory. It had served at the forefront of the war against deadly pestilence. NIH had mobilized scientists to track the epidemics of cholera, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and the 1918 Spanish flu contagion that infected and killed millions globally. Today, CDC and NIAID promote the popular orthodoxy that intrepid public health regulators, armed with innovative vaccines, played the key role in abolishing mortalities from these contagious illnesses. Both science and history dismiss this self-serving mythology as baseless. As it turns out, the pills, potions, powders, surgeries, and syringes of modern medicine played only a minor role in the historic abolition of infectious disease mortalities. An exhaustive 2000 study by CDC and Johns Hopkins scientists published in Pediatrics, the official journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics, concluded, "Thus, vaccination does not account for the impressive declines in infectious disease mortality seen in the first half of the 20th century. Nearly 90% of the decline in infectious disease mortality among U.S. children occurred before 1940, when few antibiotics or vaccines were available." Similarly, a comprehensive 1977 study by McKinley & McKinley, formerly required reading in almost all American medical schools, found that all medical interventions, including vaccines, surgeries, and antibiotics, contributed only about 1% of the decline and at most 3.5%. Both CDC and the McKinleys attributed the disappearance of infectious disease mortalities not to doctors and health officials, but to improve nutrition and sanitation, the latter credited to strict regulation of food preparation, electric refrigerators, sewage treatment, and chlorinated water. The McKinleys joined Harvard's iconic infectious disease pioneer Edward Cass in warning that a self-serving medical cartel would one day try to claim credit for these public health improvements as a pretense for imposing unwarranted medical interventions, e.g. vaccines, on the American public. As the McKinleys and Cass had predicted, Vaccinologists successfully hijacked the astonishing success story. The dramatic 74% decline in infectious disease mortalities of the first half of the 20th century, and deployed it to claim for themselves, and particularly for vaccines, a revered and sanctified and scientifically undeserving prestige beyond criticism, questioning, or debate. An agency without a mission. In 1955, as deaths from epidemic diseases declined, NIAID's forerunner organization at NIH, the National Microbiological Institute, NMI, became part of the NIAID to reflect the diminished national significance of infectious diseases and the unexplained increases in allergic and immune system diseases. Congress ordered NIAID to support innovative scientific approaches to address the causes of these diseases and find better ways to prevent and treat them. Food allergies and asthma were still rare enough to be considered remarkable. Eczema was practically unknown, as were most autoimmune diseases, including diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, Graves' disease, Crohn's disease, and myelitis. As early as 1949, congressional bills to abolish CDC because of the remarkable decline in infectious disease mortalities twice won by impressive majorities. From the mid-1970s, CDC was seeking to justify its existence by assisting state health departments to track down small outbreaks of rabies and a mouse disease called hantavirus, and by linking itself to the military's bioweapons projects. Looking back from 1994, Red Cross officer Paul Cummings told the San Francisco Chronicle that the CDC increasingly needed a major epidemic to justify its existence. According to Peter Duisberg, author of Inventing the AIDS Virus, the HIV-AIDS theory was salvation for American epidemic authorities. James Curran, the chief of the CDC's Sexually Transmitted Diseases Unit, described the desperation among the public health corps in the early 1980s. There was double-digit inflation, very high unemployment, a rapid military buildup, and a threat to decrease all domestic programs, and this led to workforce cuts at the Public Health Service, and particularly CDC. Nobel laureate Kerry Mullis similarly recalled the institutional desperation during the Reagan administration era. He said of the CDC, "They were hoping for a new plague. Polio was over. There were memos going around the agency saying, we need to find the new plague. We need to find something to scare the American people so they will give us more money." NIH scientist Dr. Robert Gallo, who would become Dr. Fauci's partner, co-conspirator, and confidant, offered a similar assessment. The CDC in Atlanta was under threat for reductions and even theoretically for closure. Drumming up public fear of periodic pandemics was a natural way for NIAID and CDC bureaucrats to keep their agencies relevant. Dr. Fauci's immediate boss and predecessor as NIAID director, Richard M. Krause, helped pioneer this new strategy in 1976 during Dr. Fauci's first year at the agency. Krause was a champion of what he called the Return of the Microbe strategy, which sought to reinstate microbes to their former status as the feared progenitors of deadly diseases. That year, federal regulators concocted a fake swine flu epidemic that temporarily raised hopes around CDC for the resurrection of its reputation as a life-saving superhero. Even in that idealistic era, regulators were allowing pharma to craft public health policy behind closed doors. Director Krause, whom Dr. Fauci would shortly succeed, invited Merck executives to sit in on internal planning meetings as collaborators. Working with Merck, NIAID used taxpayer funds to subsidize development and distribution of vaccines and to rush untested products to market. But the swine flu pandemic was a dud, and HHS's response was a global embarrassment. Only one casualty, a soldier at Fort Dix, succumbed to the pandemic, and Merck's experimental vaccine triggered a national epidemic of Guillain-Barré syndrome, a devastating form of paralysis resembling polio, before regulators recalled the jab. The four vaccine manufacturers, Merck & Company, Merrill, Wyeth, and Park Davis, had refused to sell the vaccines to the government unless they were guaranteed profits and indemnity. They were sued for $19 million within months of the vaccination campaign. The Department of Justice handled the lawsuits. Prior to 1997, the FDA forbade pharmaceutical advertising on television, and the drug companies had not yet transformed television reporters into pharmaceutical reps. Journalists, in short, were still permitted to do journalism. 60 Minutes aired a scathing segment in which Mike Wallace mercilessly exposed the corruption, incompetence, and cover-ups at HHS that led to the phony swine flu pandemic and the wave of casualties from NIH's experimental vaccine. The scandal forced the resignation of CDC Director David Censer for his role in concocting the phony pandemic and pushing the dangerous vaccine. NIAID Chief Richard Krauss quietly resigned in 1984, deeding his seat to his faithful deputy, Tony Fauci. In a poignant emblem of the ascending power of the pharmaceutical paradigm under Dr. Fauci's stewardship, the 60 Minutes report on the 1976 pandemic scandal is now largely scrubbed from the internet. You can still view it on the Children's Health Defense website. HIV/AIDS. Despite those catastrophic outcomes, Dr. Fauci's takeaway from the 1976 swine flu crisis seems to have been the revelation that pandemics were opportunities of convenience for expanding agency power and visibility, and for cementing advantageous partnerships with pharmaceutical behemoths and for career advancement. 4 years later, the AIDS pandemic proved a redemptive juncture for NIAID and the launchpad for Dr. Fauci's stellar rise. The lessons he learned from orchestrating regulatory responses to the AIDS crisis would become familiar templates for managing subsequent pandemics. Tony Fauci spent the next half century crafting public responses to a series of real and concocted viral outbreaks: HIV/AIDS in 1983, SARS in 2003, MERS in 2014, bird flu in 2005, swine flu, novel H1N1, in 2009, dengue in 2012, Ebola in 2014 through 2016, Zika in 2015 through 2016, and COVID-19 in 2020. When authentic epidemics failed to materialize, Dr. Fauci became skilled at exaggerating the severity of contagions to scare the public and further his career. Even all those years ago, Anthony Fauci had already perfected his special style of ad-fear-tizing, using remote, unlikely, far-fetched, and improbable possibilities to frighten people. Fauci helped terrify millions into wrongly believing they were at risk of getting AIDS when they were not. Emphasis in his statement is added to highlight the caveats and conditional language. The long incubation period of this disease, we may be starting to see, as we're seeing virtually as the months go by, other groups that can be involved, and seeing it in children is really quite disturbing. If the close contact of the child is a household contact, perhaps there will be a certain number of individuals who are just living with and in close contact with someone with AIDS or at risk of AIDS, who does not necessarily have to have intimate sexual contact or share a needle, but just the ordinary close contact that one sees in normal interpersonal relationships. Now, that may be far-fetched in a sense that there have been no cases recognized as yet in which individuals have had merely casual contact, close, or albeit with an individual with AIDS who, for example, have gotten AIDS. For example, there have been no cases yet reported of hospital personnel who have fairly close contact with patients with AIDS. There have been no case reports of them getting AIDS. But the jury is still out on that because the situation is constantly evolving and the incubation period is so long, as you know. It's a mean of about 14 months, ranging from 6 to 18 months. So what medical researchers and public health service officials will be, are concerned with, is what we felt were the confines of transmissibility now going to be loosening up and broadening up so that something less than truly intimate contact can give transmission of this disease. The message people took away from those 250 rambling and obfuscating words: something less than truly intimate contact can give you this disease. Translated into English, however, it's just 12 words of truth. There have been zero cases of AIDS spread by ordinary close contact. Dr. Fauci's most vocal critics complain that from his earliest days running NIAID, he was neither a competent manager nor a particularly skilled or devoted scientist. His gifts were his aptitude for bureaucratic infighting, a fiery temper, an inclination for flattering and soft-soaping powerful superiors, a vindictive and domineering nature towards subordinates and rivals who dissented, his ravenous appetite for the spotlight, and finally, his silver tongue and skilled tailor. He won his initial beachhead by wresting jurisdiction over the AIDS crisis from NIH's big kahuna, the National Cancer Institute, NCI. In 1981, the CDC first recognized the emergence of a new disease that health officials dubbed Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome, AIDS, among about 50 gay men in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York. The AIDS crisis initially landed at NCI because the condition's most pronounced signal was Kaposi's sarcoma, which was then considered a deadly skin cancer associated with immune suppression. A decade earlier, in 1971, President Nixon had launched the War on Cancer. The medical establishment promised a cancer cure by 1976. Instead, pharma quickly transformed NCI into its cash cow as captured regulators funneled hundreds of billions of dollars into single-purpose patented cancer remedies and wonder drug production that the agency developed with pharmaceutical company partners. The money enriched pharma, researchers, doctors, and universities, but yielded little net public health benefit. 50 years and $150 billion later, soft tissue and non-smoking cancers have increased dramatically. NCI, ever sensitive to offending Big Pharma, Big Food, Big Ag, and Big Chemical, had spent almost nothing to address public exposures to carcinogens from medicines, vaccines, meats, processed foods, sugar, and chemical-laden agriculture. Mainstream cancer research suggests that 1/3 of all cancers could be eliminated through lifestyle changes. But according to cancer expert Samuel Epstein, NCI spent just $1 million, that is 0.02% of its $4.7 billion budget in 2005, on education, press releases, and public relations to encourage better eating habits to prevent cancer. Under NIH's regulatory rubric, the only exposures that are permissible targets of criticism and research in that universal bugaboo are big tobacco and the sun, which doesn't pay lobbyists. NIH's unbridled criticism of UV light has made sunscreen lotions another booming profit center for Big Pharma. For pharma and its NCI regulators and enablers, the AIDS crisis looked like another ATM machine. But in 1984, NIH scientist Robert Gallo linked AIDS to his virus HTLV-3, which in time would be renamed the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV. Dr. Fauci then moved aggressively to capture that revenue stream for his agency. In a dramatic confrontation with NCI's Sam Broder that year, Dr. Fauci persuasively argued that since AIDS was an infectious disease, NIAID must have jurisdiction. His victory over NCI in that tip-off placed Dr. Fauci in position to capture the sudden flood of congressional AIDS appropriations flowing to NIH through the adept lobbying of a well-organized AIDS community then besieging the Capitol for resources to study and treat the gay plague. In 1982, congressional AIDS funding was a pitiful $297,000. By 1986, that number jumped to $63 million. The following year, it was $146 million. By 1990, NIAID's annual AIDS budget was $3 billion. But Gallo's HIV-AIDS hypothesis proved a PR windfall for Dr. Fauci as well. The most dangerous place in America is between Tony and a microphone, recalls Dr. Fauci's perennial Boswell, Charles Ortleb, the former publisher of the New York Native, the gay newspaper that chronicled the early AIDS epidemic. Once people recognized that this was caused by a virus, recalled CDC's James Curran, media attention went from no news coverage to the most covered news story in history. People went from neglecting it to fear and panic. The expanded flow of cash spelled opportunity for Dr. Fauci. AIDS was his big chance, wrote historian and journalist Bruce Nussbaum, who penned the definitive history of early AIDS research, Good Intentions, How Big Business and the Medical Establishment Are